Hello, and welcome to Intrepid Heroes Presents, a podcast where we chat about various topics related to role-playing games, typically Paizo products, such as Pathfinder and Starfinder, but also others. With me today is Ron Lindeen. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so Ron is a longtime RPG freelancer. He has his own site, actually. But also, he's got numerous credits, including both Pathfinder, Starfinder, D&D as well.
Oh, yeah.
And he's currently working at Paizo as a Pathfinder developer. So thanks again for being with us. And can you tell us a little bit about your job here at Paizo, what you do?
Yeah, sure. It's quite a bit of fun. I'm a developer, and I heard the interview that you did with Thurston Hillman, with Thirsty. Mm-hmm. He laid it out, I thought, very, very well. That what my job is to do is to outline some of the products that we've got coming out, assign those to freelance authors, and then when the freelancer turns the product back in, I go through and we do what's called a development edit. It's where our name comes from, developer. In some other industries, we're part of the editorial team here, but it's sort of a high level sort of world edit. Did the things the freelancer turn over match our vision of what the world is like? You know, if they've said, you know, goblins that are 15 feet tall, that's wrong. If they try to explain what caused the gap, that's wrong. So we, you know, go through and make sure it matches the vision of our world, and then make sure it matches the rules. That's been a lot of my work recently because I commissioned several products for Pathfinder 2nd Edition.
Right.
Which was brand new. And the freelancers that we had, in most cases, had only incomplete sets of the rules. Mm-hmm. In part because the rules weren't fully done yet. And they did a tremendous job with what they were given. But what they were given weren't the final rules. And so having to sort of realign everything so they match.
Yeah, that has to be a tremendous challenge where you're just giving them, okay, here's kind of where we're going and roughly what the rules are going to look like. They're like the old rules, but here's some changes here. And then it changes even more.
And then it changes even more, right? And here's the playtest. And some people some of the freelancers gave me back some exceptionally well-written stuff for the playtest rules. But we moved on past the playtest rules to something else.
So when that happens, do you go back and say, oh, this is great, and adapt it? Or do you go back to the freelancer and have them edit it? Or do you toss it out?
I go back and edit it myself. We very rarely ever go back to the freelancer and say, here, change this thing. Mm-hmm. That's what the developer's job is about, is making that sort of a good enough quality that then gets passed over to our formal edit team, and it goes into layout with the art team. And, The only time in my long freelance career I think I've ever been told, no, this isn't good, do it again, were with a couple of maps I've drawn for adventures where the map was, you know, I frankly kind of phoned it in, and the developer caught me. It's like, come on. This needs to be better than just a few boxes.
Yeah, I noticed you spend a lot of time with your maps now. Yeah, you showed me some of your roughs that you're doing.
I want to make sure that when I'm doing freelance, I know what it's like to get a map and whether or not it is of the quality to pass on to a cartographer to be formally done. Frankly, it's a whole different skill than writing. And I'd really like our company to move in a direction where the same way we get different people to do art and then we do writing, that we get a different people to do even map sketches, because it requires a whole different set of skills. But the way I say the development job sort of works is I can make the freelancer's turnover one step better, right? Because the freelancer turns me in something that's, it's okay. I mean, I can make it good. If they turn me in something good, I can make it great.
Right, I was saying,
I can ratchet it up one step.
Do you ever get something where it's just absolutely perfect and you don't have to do anything to it?
Oh, that is ideal. That is how we catch up around here. It's rarely a case I have to do nothing with it because our styles guide change a lot. Right. And so it's a matter of whether or not this gets italicized or in bold or whatever changes. Mm-hmm. And the freelancers, mm-hmm. you know, do their best to try to keep up with that. But so I have to go in and do something about it every time. But as far as like, a you know, freelancers that will come in and the way they describe an encounter or describe an NPC is just brilliant, right? And I don't change a word, right? Mm-hmm. So that's a lot of fun. I do have a tendency to tinker. There are two kinds. I mean, I'm sure there are a lot of different kinds of developers, But I think that primarily there are additive developers who will take the text the freelancer gets and do kind of add more onto it. Mm-hmm. If it doesn't connect, if a scene in an adventure doesn't connect quite so well to the scenes on either side of it.
Right, because the freelancer is only getting one snapshot.
That's right. Then they will build stuff in. The second kind of developer, which is the kind that I am, is more of a revisionist developer, where I take the text that's there and I'll make changes in the text to make it fit. So I'm not throwing a whole bunch extra in. I'm sort of finessing
what's there.
Oh,
right. I see what you're
saying.
Yeah.
So I think that if you're a freelancer, and I mean, I can do this as a freelancer. I can see when it's something's gone to an additive developer.
Right.
Most of my words are still there. There's just a bunch of extra words. And when it's gone to a revision developer,
right? You see,
like me,
oh, here's the transition. Here's the linkage.
That's right.
This is what's going on. That makes sense.
And that is one of the things that I try to do to make me valuable as a freelancer is make sure that I'm doing as much as I can to stay up on the styles, that I make sure that I'm leaving sort of very open-ended transitions. As an example, with the adventure paths that has six volumes that are all written by a different person, part of the developer's job is to make sure that the first one flows into the second one, flows into the third one, flows into the fourth one, which is a little bit of a challenge because totally different people wrote them, even though they wrote them from one master outline, like 80-page outline.
Right. Wow.
If you're a writer, you're expected to know kind of what came before and what came after, but something that is like particularly inspired in an early volume that we may want to call in as a later volume, it means tying some of those connections in.
Right.
And so what I try to do is make sure that whatever I've got, I'm putting in sort of open-ended connections on either side, so the developer can be, you know, finesse it. It's easy to just finesse it in order to make
it. Yeah, when you see an open-ended connection, what does that look like?
If I know that, for example, the adventure I'm writing is on Verses, and I know that the next adventure is going to take place on, I don't know, anywhere else.
At Castrovelle or something.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Then what I want to do is I want to end mine with, here is an NPC that can get you there and may have a ship to get you there.
Oh, okay.
So the developer, who may have an idea in his or her mind, oh, I know how they're going to get from one to the other.
Right.
I established way back at the beginning they're going to get a special ship, and I haven't told any of the writers that. But what I want to do is make it easy for the developer to be like, oh, here's kind of a connection already.
Ron's
introduced this NPC. Oh, yeah, the NPC gets you to Castrovelle.
Okay. Interesting.
And I want to say that attention to sort of that kind of detail is the sort of thing that keeps them asking for me to do more work.
So you've written for both Pathfinder Adventure Paths and the Starfinder Adventure Paths.
Right.
And the Pathfinder ones are quite a bit longer.
About 50% longer.
Yeah. So what's the difference in the challenge, I guess, between those two other than the length? So first of all, why did they make them longer? Is there something about the context that requires it? Because I don't know. And then the second thing is there different challenges between the two sets? And you could go with Pathfinder 2.0.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, they don't. The reason they're that long is because you can't make them shorter without making people mad, right?
The adventure
paths for Pathfinder, I think because they pulled off of a magazine origin that they were the magazine length. And when we did Starfinder, we intentionally said, okay, we're going to make these a little bit shorter.
Okay.
Everything from the Starfinder side. Because remember when it started, we had no idea it was going to be the success it was. So we're like, well, we don't want to commit a 600-page book. Let's maybe commit a 300-something page book, right? Or instead of a 250-page bestiary, let's do a 100, maybe 140-page alien archive. So, and it was the same with the adventure paths, so those are a little bit shorter. The biggest change between them, I think, in writing them, when I'm writing any specific adventure path, is that for Starfinder, you can have consistent challenges all the way through because the level band is narrower. And in Pathfinder,
you can't, because
if you're spanning two levels for Starfinder, you know, a bunch of, you know, thugs, a bunch of, you know, drow thugs, cyber mercenaries that you face as the very first encounter of the scenario, you can have just a couple more of them, and that's your encounter.
So scaling is a little bit easier.
Scaling is much easier in Starfinder. And then in Pathfinder, by the time you start, if you start something level 5 and you're level 8 by the end of it, then you're sort of totally outclassed those beginning encounters.
And so that
forces a little more variety. But you've got the room to have that more variety.
Right, that makes sense.
So it kind of fits. Yeah. I do think that Starfinder would really benefit from a longer length. And I think that part of the reason that Pathfinder has such a robust sort of lore in the world is not just because it's been around for several years longer. It's because the back matter of the adventure paths is, oh, yeah, you want to deep dive right on the dwarven god of toil. Well, we so happen to have this huge article about the dwarven god of toil. Mm-hmm. Starfinder, I think, could really benefit from that. You see some of the back matter articles they have, where it's like, here's some, you know, relics of this forgotten race, and here's, you know, the these warp locales in the drift and so on. But I just think there's more room for that to help build the world more, which is, I think, is sort of makes the whole thing more fun.
So you've worked on these adventure paths. I know you wrote Into the Unknown, which was the first
kind of quest
for for Starfinder. Have you worked on any of the books? I'm not aware of your
Of some of the upcoming things. Yes, yeah. I've got a very little bit of contribution to the Character Operations Manual,
right?
And then a little bit more. On some of the upcoming products that we've got.
You did stuff in the armory too, you mentioned.
I did in the armory.
That's right.
I did actually kind of a lot. I keep doing more power armor than there's room for. I want to say Pact Worlds originally was going to have a power armor section, but the whole thing got cut.
Yeah.
And then when they did power armor for the armory, I didn't know that it had been cut, so I did a whole bunch new more power armors, and then many of those power armors made it in, but not all of them. So we have floating around in sort of a cut file lots of power armor that I wrote.
You must like that power armor thing.
That I do. In fact, my contribution to the Character Operations Manual is a power armor user archetype.
Oh,
there we go.
That's
of a power
spoiler.
Armor guy.
Nice.
Yep.
Nice.
So anyway, But that's a lot of fun. So there are some rules items that are coming up that people have occasionally put their stake in. I've done some of the aliens in the Alien Archive books.
Oh, cool. Which ones have you done?
I did in the latest Alien Archive. There is a the giant space tardigrade.
Oh yeah,
the water bears.
Yeah.
So they're super interesting little animals. Yeah. Extremophiles, And so when I was thinking with each assignment to the Alien Archive, it's suggested that you have some player facing element. Either here's how you play this monster as a race, or here's some weapons the monsters use that the players can use. And so what I did with the giant space tardigrade is, on the assumption that once you defeat it, its body will shrivel up just a little bit. It becomes the chassis for a vehicle.
Oh.
So you could fly around. It's an underwater vehicle, actually. Yeah. You can basically just pilot around underwater in your little water bear. That was a lot of fun.
So when you're working on these various types of projects, and so these are freelance projects when you're talking about writing things, and that's in addition to the development work you're doing as well.
Yep, that's right. The development work that I do that is for the Pathfinder Adventure Paths, sort of, you know, the 9 to 5 or the 10 to 6, the on the clock here, is separate from the writing that I do.
Oh, so your Starfinder APs, that was freelance work.
That's all freelance.
That's not development
That's
work.
Correct. The only Starfinder the only Starfinder development work that I've done is I jumped in, I want to say last year, to help develop some of the Starfinder Society scenarios.
Oh.
Sort of help Thirsty out. There's a little crush around the beginning of convention season.
Right, I jumped in,
and a couple of the scenarios I developed, Save the Rank Rotas was one that I developed.
Oh, that is a cool one. Yeah.
That was the but anyway, so I'm willing to jump in sort of from time to time. I think that's one of the things that a lot of us do, is it ends up being, you know, got to get these 6 monsters done by the end of the day. Well, let me take 2 of them, and she'll take another 2, and that way we'll get them all done. Things like that. We help each other out. There's a lot of sort of crossing the lines. I wish there were more of it, frankly, but it really helps us all sort of stay in touch.
And you've been here at Paizo about a year and a half now?
Yeah, about a year and a half. Almost 2 years.
Oh, two,
actually,
so. 2 years in December, right?
Yep, that's correct.
How did you get here? What did you do before?
Oh, so this is... So anyway, so I was a lawyer for several years.
A lawyer?
I was, yes.
Not a rules lawyer, but a real lawyer.
An actual lawyer. That's why my email address, Rules Lawyer Ron, has sort of been an in-joke. I've had that for forever.
Yeah.
So I went to law school in Chicago, graduated, went to work for a big firm downtown, Worked there for about 6 or 7 years. And
what type of law did you practice?
It's all transactional, so I wasn't in the court. And it was primarily healthcare law. A lot of my clients were dialysis clinics and ambulatory surgery centers, sort of helping these companies get founded and things like that. It was a lot of sort of technical, a lot of regulatory work. There are a lot of restrictions on sort of what people can and can't, how they can and can't refer people, and how they can and can't, you know, share the money and things like that. So you had to be really good with rules then. We're very good with rules. It was all very technical.
Yeah.
But I was doing some freelance writing sort of on the side. But it was a little bit frustrating. You know, the big firm jobs, they'll take up all your whole life. And then, you know, the day I had to work until 10 p.m. on my wife's birthday, I thought to myself, man, I would take less money if I could work less hours.
And
it turns out you go in-house with a company. So I went in-house with Walgreens. You know, I hadn't done a lot of pharmacy, but I'd done a lot of health law. And so I worked at Walgreens for, oh gosh, another 6 or 7 years, which was great. You know, there in Illinois, loved it. I was a director. I had the team of lawyers underneath me that were just fantastic. And I had enough time to really dig more deeply into the freelance that I love to do. And then when Paizo had an opening for a developer, I thought, man, I could totally switch my gears entirely and do that.
Give up the lawyer life. That's a huge change.
It did. I've had, and I wouldn't have been able to do it without my wife's support. I mean, I second guessed myself a lot through the application process and whether or not, the more real it became, we started sort of looking at houses out here, I'm like, no, I can't do this to my family, and this is such an enormous pay cut, and what if I don't love it, and so on and so on. But my wife was there sort of every step of the way going, no, this is your dream, let's do it.
Wow, that is cool.
I haven't entirely given up on the law. I just recently got my bar membership in the state of Washington,
and
I've been helping with a local university that I'm doing some mentoring for law students at a local law school, which has been a lot of fun. So keep my foot in it a little bit. The contracts that we send out to our freelancers here, I've looked at. I have some comments about how they might be done better, but I'm not Paizo's lawyer.
That's good.
Keep that to myself. But yeah, it's actually been an absolutely fantastic transition.
So how did you get into freelancing in the first place, you know, to be able to make that big jump?
Well, I've been doing this for quite a long time. Most of my freelance work has been in the adventure space. I started, I want to say my first freelance was, I want to say in the early 90s for a game called Torg, which I love and still actually write for now that the new version is out. But the bulk of what I did was I was a writer and a volunteer for the Living Greyhawk campaign.
Right.
And so I wrote a ton of adventures right around 2000, the early 2000s. Was in the administration there. And then I was able to parlay that into work for the Pathfinder Society when that was real early on. At the time, they were doing an open call for new adventure authors. And I pitched to Mark Moreland, who's still here at Paizo. I said, hey, there was a great adventure early on called Tide of Morning. Make sure I get the names right. I think there was one that was called Tide of Morning, and I pitched a sequel called Tide of Twilight, but I might have those names switched.
Okay.
At any rate, I wrote one of the Twilights, intended to be as a sequel to the other one, sort of a spiritual successor to it. And he loved it. He gave me a chance, said, okay, go ahead and write this. One of those Pathfinder Society adventures is about 10,000 words long. And oh man, I agonized over that, right? Because I knew this was kind of like my one chance to impress him, right? So I sort of pulled out all the stops and, you know, made sure it was as good as I possibly could, fit all the styles and everything, and then, you know, was telling a rousing tale. And he loved it, fortunately.
Wow.
So I got more work.
That's a lot different than Thirsty's experience. He did something similar, then they said they
hated it.
They hated it, yeah. So it's like, wow, okay.
This one I'd done. Yeah. He had his tales of rejection. I'd gotten tons of rejection already because I tried to submit to Dungeon Magazine.
Right.
And I go, man, the rejection letters I've got from them, I really took sort of when they'd say no and here's why, which is really good. I kind of took that to heart to make myself a better adventure writer. Anyway, so I sort of followed Mark through as he started working on other product lines, the players, companions, and the campaign settings for Pathfinder. I started to do more and more work for him. And I remember because I lived in Chicago, I was just 2.5 hour drive from Gen Con every year. So I'd go down to Gen Con every year. It was in Milwaukee, it was even closer. But 1 year I wasn't going to go to Gen Con, Mark emailed me and said, hey, you know, would you going to be at Gen Con, you're interested in meeting James Jacobs. And I knew James Jacobs is the guy who assigns the adventure path lines, which is what I really wanted to be doing.
Right.
So I told Mark, I'm like, yes, I'm absolutely coming down. He said, well, how about meeting at 2 on Sunday or whatever? And so I actually just drove down to meet with James Jacobs.
Didn't go to Gen Con.
Yeah. Just met with him to talk about my first adventure path that I wrote. And the opportunity to get that in. And I did. I loved that. I thought it was great. It was sort of the tech adventure path called Iron Gods before we even had a Starfinder.
Yeah,
doing tech
very
stuff.
Cool. So had you already drafted something, like an outline idea, or they brought you the outline?
No, he did. The way this starts is what he did, and now I know the process sort of very intimately, having done it myself. What he did is he had sort of a rough outline sort of on his computer. He's like, I'm going to need 6 authors.
Right.
Let me find authors that are interested.
Got it.
And so he was making sure I was one of the interested authors, whether I would be interested in low, middle, or high level and stuff like that. And so then just within a couple of days after I'd said yes, I think I was one of the last people to say, you know, yes, I'm in. So he had his 6 locked in. He got the approval around the office here for the outline and then sent it to all 6 of us in order to do our work. And then since then, I've been sort of all over the way around high-level stuff and low-level stuff and, you know, all over. Adventures are really what I love. I'm excited to have contributed as much as I have for Starfinder, you know, for the Against the Aeon Throne, and then Dawn of Flame. I've got the 4th one there.
Yep.
I've got the 6th in the Attack of the Swarm.
Oh, see, I haven't seen that one yet, so I don't know.
It's coming. Oh, man.
Yeah.
That was actually really cool because concluding an adventure path like that that has a consistent theme of fight space bugs.
Right.
One of the ways to make that interesting is to tie together a lot of the NPCs and the themes sort of throughout.
Right.
So it's not just an endless log of space bugs, but there's like a real story there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I actually worked very closely with Jason Keeley, who's the developer there, to make sure that my adventure had a lot of thematic ties and location ties with the first adventure. And so my hope is by the time people get to the end of the adventure path, they're like, oh, you're right back to the beginning. We're tying it all together kind of in a big circle.
Yeah, that'll be good.
So
that'll
I think that'll be kind of neat. And he was trying to seed some of the stuff in my adventure earlier in the adventure path.
I just started playing book 1. So,
okay.
Yeah, So don't talk.
Oh, I'm not saying anything. But it's – anyway. So that was an awful lot of fun. And then I've got a one I can't talk about that is upcoming.
Yeah, no, that's cool. That's great. Hopefully we'll see something about that sometime down the road.
Yep.
So do you have some advice for people trying to break into freelancing and writing and developing and getting to where you are eventually, or
where
you were anyway?
Well, there's I think the most important thing to stress is that there isn't one path. Right, I'm sure everybody you've talked to has an entirely different way of getting to where they are. And the thing that I can stress the most is to just keep at it, keep writing. One of the reasons I think that I had a lot of success as a freelancer is because I was always writing. And even when I didn't have a formal assignment for something, I always had ideas that I wanted to get out. I started my own third-party press, Runamuck Games.
What's the website for that?
At runamuckgames.com.
Oh, excellent.
In primarily just to get some of the ideas in my head out when nobody was paying me to write them.
Right.
So I think that even though that was never anything that was particularly lucrative, I may have made as many as dozens of dollars on on those. But what it did, it gave me a lot of the experience of actually sitting down to say, all right, now I'm in the process of writing. I now understand this adventure doesn't connect very well. In this adventure, the beginning and the middle don't connect nearly as well.
Right.
How do I fix that? How do I make it?
So doing your own development and your own freelancing with it.
That's right. In order to make it as good as I possibly can. On my blog on runamuckgames.com, I've got a blog that mostly I had used for product announcements, but about a year ago, I decided to be a little more rigorous in giving out just some tips of what I found.
Yeah, so. I noticed. I didn't realize that was this, you know, the last year, because when I started going to it, you were doing these tips.
It seemed like it had been all along.
Yeah.
That's actually, you know, it's been about a year, and it's actually been a lot of fun because it lets me explain a lot of things from a very high level about how a villain but like how a villain's motivations ought to be truly villainous instead of just being like, you know, an ugly guy, right? You know, what does a villain do? Well, villains do bad things. So for very high level conceptual like that, down to here's the right way to draw a 45 degree angled hall, right? And the wrong way to draw a 45 degree angled hall on a map. So I do an awful lot of stuff with that. It's been a lot of fun. With the advent of the new edition of Pathfinder, I've sort of challenged myself to build an entire adventure path,
right,
and sort of put the adventure path sort of right out in front of everybody. So
yeah, your process as you're going and doing things. I liked your post today about naming and confirming, doing Google searches on names and saying the names out loud to make sure that they aren't somebody else's IP and that they don't sound like something else and things like that. I thought that was really good.
I did have a couple of times when I've been sort of put a name together and only realized later once I've said it out loud, sounds bad.
Yeah.
I do benefit from having a couple of particularly filthy-minded friends who I will run names by, and they're here's what that means. I'm like, okay, then I'm changing it. But that's been a lot of fun. I think that the process of writing an adventure path as anybody could have known when I started out to do it sort of on my blog in front of people is, around this is going to take a lot longer than you think.
Right.
So it's taking a lot longer than I think. But it's fun to do. And it's neat to think that by the time that I get it done, I'll have something, even if it's just a framework.
When you first set it out is you kind of took like a project management approach. You took the overall big picture of here's 30,000 words I need to do. Here's what these are going to be broken down into, you know, for sub-adventures or sub-parts and things like that, to make it much more, you know, individual pieces more manageable. You know, if you talk to somebody and say, hey, I'm going to write an adventure path, it's like, I'm going to write a novel, right? You don't just write the whole thing. You break it down into chapters and sub-parts and things like that. And so to see that part of, I thought, was actually one of the most beneficial parts.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I appreciate that. I think that's actually a good way to tackle any of these products. I will say that for the development that I do, I don't do it. I don't do any of my writing from the beginning to the end. There's an adventure that I'm writing now for Pathfinder 2nd Edition that I haven't done the beginning of, but I'm about done with the second third and the third third. And then when I develop, one of the things that I often do is I'll develop an adventure that comes in not from the front to the back, but from the back to the front. So the first thing I'll tackle is, how does this end? And then I make sure that all of the encounters that lead up to it are leading towards that end.
Wow, so it's a really tight linkage that way.
That's the hope. Yeah. That's the hope. So at my desk today is one where I've got the ending very solid, and I'm building up to it. It's been easy. The author, despite having incomplete set of rules, told an exceptionally compelling story, and that's a delight to see. That's something that makes me excited to come in every day.
So for an AP book, how much time is given to a freelancer when they say, okay, you're assigned this book, you get this amount of time to work on it?
Well, that's in the process of changing. It's a good question. Generally, writing an adventure like that is going to take 3 months.
Okay.
And in that 3 months, we're expecting you not only to write the adventure, but produce all of the maps for it, supplemental NPCs that go with it, and then to the extent you've got any new monsters that are sort of required for your adventure, new monsters that are required for your adventure. So that's the time that we've been giving people. We want to give more time because we want our adventure authors to do more stuff. Right now, we have started in the Pathfinder line, and this isn't something that hasn't yet bled over into Starfinder, but we've had a lot of success with it so far, is the back stuff in the adventure that is all the new rules and the new monsters and the NPCs. We've sort of put all together in something called the Adventure Toolbox.
Oh,
so cool. The Adventure Toolbox contains all the rules that help run the adventure. So you'll see in a Starfinder adventure, it'll have like, and the PCs find a new item, and here it is listed right here as a sidebar. Well, that's the kind of thing that would go back in the Adventure Toolbox. Under the theory that that's a separate section that you kind of dole out to the players sort of more easily as they find it. Ideally, we would like every adventure author to write not only the adventure, but the entirety of that Adventure Toolbox. Not just all the new. So we don't have, for example, an issue where there's 10 new monsters and 3 of them appear in the adventure. We have 10 new monsters and all 10 appear in the adventure. We've got 5 new magic items and every one of them appears in the adventure. And to the extent we've got an article about a gazetteer where the setting takes place, or a, an article about a deity that's important. I think that's
all. And normally that would have been different authors completing those sections. Right.
Yep, we parcel that out. We're not there yet. We're not to a point where we're expecting any one human to write front to back 96 pages.
Right.
But if we get there, we'll have to give people more time. There's just not enough time to do that in 3 months.
Wow. So what's the future hold for Ron? What's your big vision for what's coming down the road?
That's good. I actually had a friend of mine who about a year ago was saying, so what's – he asked me that. He's like, so what's next, right? What's your what's your next move?
Yeah.
And I thought about it for a minute. I'm like, I'm kind of here, right? I mean – what I've wanted to do all along professionally is work in gaming. Mm-hmm. And my love is adventures. And so I get to work on adventures as my job all day.
That's it. You've reached the pinnacle. You're
done. Oh. Right. Where do I go from here? I'm here. I do think that there are some exciting ways that we could be presenting adventures both in Pathfinder and Starfinder. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to be presenting those. There are some of the ways that we actually like get our adventure content to the consumer, fundamentally Paizo is a magazine company, and so we've got kind of a lot of magazine company thinking, as far as putting out print products. I think there's a lot of opportunity in electronic media. We already, if you're a subscriber, you get the interactive maps, which help. And I think we've got, we work closely with companies like Archives of Nethys in order to get all the rules out to make sure those are available electronically. But I think that there are a lot more options that are becoming available now to present sort of adventure content to people electronically in a lot of different ways. So there's a lot of fun stuff. There are some things that we're moving on in this direction that I don't think anybody is not yet formalized in order to have any sort of public announcement about, but there are things that are really exciting. And as far as I'm concerned, what I want to do is I want to help people tell awesome stories with their friends. And all these are more exciting ways to do just that.
Nice. Very cool. Well, Ron, thanks for spending the time chatting. It's been great knowing you, actually, for these couple of years and playing with you. Ron is actually one of the players in our Intrepid Heroes podcast where we're going through Dawn of Flame. We've just completed book one, and we're starting book two tomorrow.
That is awesome.
So I hope you've leveled up your character.
I have, and helped Stephanie level up her character as well. Okay. Third level is kind of a big power jump.
Yeah,
That's kind of amazing.
Yeah, weapon specialization, new things, another feat. So, all right. Well, thanks again.
Sure.